Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We have two very interesting guests, Mike Murphy and Stuart Stevens. Now, I'm going to introduce Stuart Stevens as the Zen master of American politics. I couldn't come up with anything better because you describe yourself as American traveler and political consultant, and you're actually talking to us from Canada. Is that right, Stu?
Yeah, I am. I'm looking for Ted Cruz's birth certificate. It's looking hopeful. I might be able to come up with it any day now.
And Mike Murphy, who describes himself as an infuriated GOP consultant, and the host of what do you call it? Radio Free GOP,
which the voice of the Republican rage resistance. Yeah, I fool around for podcasts too, and I'm the rage monster, I guess, American politics, thanks to our president.
Yeah, well, I just told you guys. Speaking of rage monsters, the kind of the mood that I'm in. But since I'm going to keep this podcast safe for work, I'm not going to quote it except to say that there's a line from Samuel L. Jackson from one of the great American movies of the last century, Snakes on a Plane, that keeps going through my mind. That I'm at that point that we need to open some windows here. So anyway, where do you want to start today? We could start with the president and John McCain. We could talk about the latest we've learned about Jared Kushner. We could talk about Nikki Haley or Mike Pompeo saying that it is certainly possible that God himself raised up Donald Trump to be president. Because I'm actually random. Who wants to take on Mike Pompeo saying that it's possible that God raised up Donald Trump to be president?
Well, I'm pretty sure, Charlie, if God was involved, Trump could have pulled off winning the popular vote. At least God could have done.
The hand of God is only found in the Electoral College, right?
Yeah, and I suppose God was busy when, like, North Korea was voting.
Yeah, well, I'm in Wisconsin right now, and I'm pretty sure the hand of God was not on Wisconsin in November of 2016.
And I've heard about a vengeful God, but I don't think even with the sin we've been working on in the last decade, we deserve this, because I think God should dial it back to a plague of locusts or something a little more reasonable than the Trump presidency. I mean, come on, it's overkill.
Well, there are, you know, if you go through
early on in my career, I had a great client who was actually very religious in the best ways. And when supporters would say that God were with him, he used to say, "I think God has better things to do than follow the tracking."
So, if you go through the Old Testament, God does not always do good things for folks. Okay, so you guys are political consultants. Let's talk about Joe Biden and Joe Biden dealing with the problem of being a 70-year-old white guy in a political party that seems to be still rather excited about people like AOC. So more specifically, if you're sitting in a room with Joe Biden and somebody says, "What do we do about this? How about we announce that Stacey Abrams is going to be our vice presidential running mate? Good idea or bad idea?" Who wants to jump on this one first?
Mike, you go.
Oh, okay. Thanks, Stuart. No, look, I'm always against too clever by half ideas. And the problem is they often orbit around the vice presidential thing. So if you're Biden and you think, "Boy, I've got a lot of problems, I will go pick somebody that'll, quote, solve all my problems." Well, one, it never does, because people vote for president. And two, Stacey Abrams now owns Joe Biden, so he's selling cheap. I would go fix Biden, run as what Biden is, which does bring some assets to the table, and then pick the VP later from a commanding position. This gimmicky stuff just screams weakness to me. I get it on paper, but I think just quickly, the other problem is the groupthink, which is almost always wrong at the beginning of a presidential campaign. I know, because I'm the idiot who spent $100 million on the unstoppable Jeb Bush campaign, you know, the early front runner. You have to mistrust all that. So when we get all this noise about, "Oh, the Democratic Party has gone completely communist and they want old Ocasio-Cortez / Che Guevara et to run," you know, we've all got to pander to that. Now, step back. There are more than 30 million Democratic primary voters. And if you actually ask them, rather than the Twitter sphere or the CW media, they're not all screaming liberals. So Joe's holding better cards than he thinks. And if I were him, I wouldn't try to hire Stacey Abrams to redefine me as something I'm not.
So, Stuart.
I agree totally with Mike. I think if I was Joe Biden, I'd ask myself, what are the odds I'm going to be president? You don't know. What are the odds if you run? What are the odds I'm going to be president if I don't run? They're really bad. I would just run. What do you have to lose? I don't have any reason to believe that he wouldn't have done better than Hillary Clinton were he the nominee. I mean, I think there's states that he would have carried. If for nothing else, you know, the idea that America wasn't voting for a woman for president would have made it easier for him. So you never know the degree to which when parties will go sane and when they will go crazy. Republican Party's gone crazy. It's possible the Democratic Party will use that as a role model and go crazy and nominate someone who can't win. But you just have to bet that that's not going to happen. And parties tend to invent leaders. Countries tend to invent leaders when they need them. Churchill was certainly washed up. Margaret Thatcher had run and lost a bunch of times. We look back on them, they seem inevitable. That history was on their side, which, of course, you know, is wrong. But the one thing they do have in common is they put themselves forward, and they actually gave themselves a chance to lead. And that's, I think, what Biden needs to do.
All right, but the Stacey Abrams thing, and I agree with Mike on this. It just reeks of gimmick, and I'm trying to imagine the internal dynamic, because of course the moment he did it, instead of focusing on Joe Biden, you know, all the oxygen would be taken up with Stacey Abrams, and then Joe Biden owns everything that Stacey Abrams has ever done or said, all of her position. So, give me some sense, Mike, because you mentioned the groupthink. The dynamic that goes on inside the room when a candidate is about to launch, and how these bad ideas circulate. Do you understand what I'm asking here?
Totally. Yeah. it's an obsession of mine, so I'm going to sound like the ranting fool on the hill for a minute. But what happens is, unfortunately, campaigns often have too many meetings. Mm-hmm. And when the meeting starts, I'm generalizing unfairly, but you know, it's hard to get to the real work. Hey, what's our strategy to get a party to get an old guy like Biden when the Democrats tend to have historically gone for young guys? And the Southern primaries are dominated by a block of African-American voters. Oh, my God, we're screwed. So then somebody goes for the miracle answer. I've got it. Two words, Sarah Palin, or, you know, whatever it is that's going to change everything. When the fact is the VP is leveraged to be more of a problem for you than an advantage. My view is the smart move of vice presidents is pick yourself so there's very little daylight. When Clinton figured out that Southern white Protestants did pretty well and the Democrats nominated them, he picked another one, Al Gore, slightly different flavor, but there wasn't a lot of daylight. I mean, I always joke about what I call him. Stewart's a Hollywood guy. I work out here, too. The agent rule, which is, let's say you're you're Robert Redford's agent, big superstar, not working as much. Your agent gets a call. Hey, we're going to do Titanium Man, the big new Iron Man prequel, and we want Redford. And of course, the agent says, great, he's doing push-ups right now. Never looked younger. He'd love it. And then the studio guy says, and guess what? He's got a sidekick, Zinc Man. And Zinc Man, we've been talking to Brad Pitt. Well, if you're Robert Redford's agent, you say, wow, great idea, but we were thinking Abe Vigoda because there's one star. And when you start picking VPs, you get into some of the kind of trouble my beloved friend John did when you all of a sudden have kind of a sidekick who's getting more interest, and then the contrast between you and the sidekick becomes the story. Plus, you own them, as you said. So, yeah, I think it's crazy, but nobody wants to tell Biden, hey, you're going to have to be a disciplined candidate, stay on message, don't act like Dean Martin in the late night fifth show, you know, screw the casino, I'm going all night and vamp. You're going to have to learn discipline you never had to go through this process. So instead, they start doing this Wunderweppen stuff with, well, we can either, maybe we can call Kamala and she'll drop out and then we're going to win and she'll be our VP. It's just dumb and it demeans them. Stewart's exactly right. You can't game all this stuff out. You go run as the best version of you. And Biden can sell adult and he can sell Obama a bit. And that could be an okay ticket in this primary. So it's a bad sign.
It's particularly ironic. We don't really know the degree to which this is, as far as I know, this is seriously being considered inside Biden world. There's a bunch of smart people there. And I would be surprised if later we didn't learn that this was something that was floated by maybe the Stacey Abrams people.
Yeah.
But if you look at why are we talking about Joe Biden, we're talking about Joe Biden because he was picked by Barack Obama. Why was he picked by Barack Obama? Because he was safe. And he would not lose the election because he picked Joe Biden.
Mm-hmm.
So it would be particularly ironic if that premise, which worked well, if the Biden campaign decided to throw that out the window. I don't think they will. I think they're really smart. I think they're sensible, solid, experienced people. And I doubt this was ever really that serious of an idea.
So has the vice presidential nominee ever actually determined the outcome of the election, do you think? I mean, we obsess about it. Yeah. The only one I can possibly think of was Lyndon Johnson in 1960. Is that plausible?
You have to go back to a slightly, you know, a different era. And the farther you go back to the world of coalition politics, I mean, you know, some people make an argument about Palin. I don't believe that she cost John the election. But the choice of the real story of Palin was how it defined McCain, the decision maker. And it did not favor him because it didn't really fit his great strength as a maverick, do what's right for the country. And then we wind up with kind of a lightweight, PR friendly choice from a tiny state we'd win anyway. So, you know, I think she might have been a drag, but I don't think you can say, and, you know, who knows, but that she cost him it. But no, I think they're generally overrated, though, as Stuart just pointed out. They're a good ticket for the future if you are picked as VP and you're on a winning team. And then when George H.W. Bush, you know, you're in a position to do very well yourself. So it's a good starting gun for people.
Was that the worst VP choice ever, though? Sarah Palin? Because I'm going back to the sort of the science of bad decision making. You know, things that seem like a good idea inside the room. And then you walk out and you go, what the hell happened there?
I've
been in those rooms when bad decisions were made, and you kind of go crazy. And what a campaign needs is someone who says, look, you understand you're going crazy.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, you know, writing bad poems late at night when you're in college and drinking. You know, you need someone next morning to say, this is like the worst stuff ever. Don't show it to anybody. And I think that the McCain campaign just got in a bad moment when that didn't happen. And I think most of the people involved would say that now.
Yeah, they would say that now, but of course, in the moment. Now, we're recording this. We ought to make it clear in this at this moment. Let's see, it's about 11:16 Eastern Standard Time. I'm mentioning that because, of course, there is this feverish speculation that the Mueller report may drop any minute now. And of course, we're in this where everyone is in America not having any idea whether that's true or not or what's going to be in the report. So I just wanted to flag that for folks. My gut sense is, and absolutely knowing nothing, that this report is likely to change nothing in American politics. But explain why I'm wrong. The reason I'm saying that is, of course, is that, you know, the Trump folks, the Trump base is going to will claim victory and some sort of vindication no matter what is in that report. And of course, there will be enough in the report that we'll get the people who don't like Trump to say that, here's all of this misconduct. So we're going to be consumed by this for the next couple of weeks, but 2 weeks from now, I'm guessing that the poll numbers haven't moved at all. Am I wrong about this? Feel free to say I'm wrong.
You're wrong, Charlie. No, no.
Good, okay.
we don't know. I would say first it'll be depressing because we will have this process, which is totally legitimate work, and today will be like a debate spin room if it comes out today or tomorrow, whenever. Right. People walking around with signs. There'll be a huge character attack on Bob Mueller, who's a hero. Last time I checked, he has more Bronze Stars and Purple Hearts than Donald Trump does. So we have this corrosive thing where we try to tear down institutions in this mad scrum to, like, declare victory. And I think your instinct is right. Both sides will dig in. I mean, the problem is the fact that Trump's a jerk and a creep, a liar and a cheat is already built into his numbers to some extent. Right. That said, his numbers are terrible. So if the numbers don't change for the better, a heavy lift, that's a loss for Donald Trump, who's in real trouble. There's kind of this halcyon bubble in the Republican congressional wisdom, you know, world in D.C. that oh, we don't have to worry about Trump anymore. The Democrats are going to commit suicide with their nominee. I'd be careful about betting the ranch on that, which is why the party seems, you know, kind of in the zombie state about Trump. They don't quite understand what we could be facing in 2020, which could look a lot like 2018. So my guess is you're right, but, you know, we have to see. The one missing link or missing, well, I won't make the obvious missing link joke, but the one loose end is how the report makes Trump act. You know, he could wig out even more. He's high on the scale right now, but he could really spiral. And yeah, maybe that could cause some different outcome in the data, which, again, net net, no change is bad for Trump if it doesn't get better.
Okay, Stuart.
Look, if you step back from this, we have a Republican president whose strongest group is evangelicals, whose son is writing checks for his dad to pay off a porn star in a hush money scandal right before the election. And that's okay. So I really don't know what the Republican Party believes in anymore. I mean, I was drawn to the party when it was the character counts, personal responsibility, strong on Russia, fiscal sanity, strong on national debt. We believed in a big tent party, or at least we said we did. And I wake up these days now, and I feel like a guy who was working for Bernie Madoff who actually thought we were beating the market.
Yep.
I mean, I believe this stuff. And you know, there's increasing evidence that they were just marketing slogans, that they didn't mean anything. So we now have a party that used to be the Law and Order Party that is deeply, deeply invested in attacking the fundamental institutions of law enforcement in the country because they're inconvenient. Which is what the mob did. But we're now on that side. And we're going to hug up on Putin's side because the president hugs up on Putin. So I really don't know where the touchstone is. I tend to think it's about power and not even big power like Supreme Court, but more like parking places. Who's going to get appointed to a landmark committee?
Yeah, yeah.
So who knows?
I was actually speaking at a college yesterday, and the first question that the moderator asked me was, "What is conservatism today?" And I have to admit that I'm scarcely at a loss for words, but I had to say, I hate to answer this, but I don't know anymore. I had pretty much the same answer that you had. What I think is interesting is, and I did this something with Ben Wittes at Lawfare a couple of days ago, where we sort of walk through all of the things that we already know that Mueller has found out, all of the conspiracy, everything. The problem is that it all played out in public over a long period of time. If we learned everything we already know all at once, if it wasn't, if the president was not openly obstructing justice on Twitter and we found out he was doing it in taped phone calls, it would be absolutely nuclear. But the fact is, we have been numbed. I mean, we are the collective frog that has been boiled. We've had the obstruction of justice play out in public in real time for a year and a half. We've had the evidence of the conspiracy, the collusion, whatever you want to call it, play out in real time. We've learned all of these things, but I think they have all been baked into the cake. And we will see it, not speculate. So let's get into this. What is the McCain thing? I bring this up because the easiest possible test for Republicans who are looking for a way to distance themselves from Trump or simply stand up as decent human beings by defending the memory of John McCain. And as we are speaking, the number of Republicans that actually said anything is vanishingly small. And I'm just seeing on Twitter that Dan Crenshaw, who up until yesterday was beloved of the Trumpian right, he defends McCain and he's being absolutely trashed, and everybody else is hiding out. So, let's just talk about and when Trump went, I was actually had to do one of these cable hits right after Trump did his rant in Lima, Ohio, and I said, I'm just out of words to describe how despicable all of this is. So I'm guessing Mike Murphy is not out of words.
Well, I'm pretty much out of words. I mean, there is no bottom with Trump. We've now discovered what infinity is. And it's, what do you say? It just is a world upside down. I think we're now in the world of bizarro, sick irony, too, to have Donald Trump.
Yes.
Who is a fluke president stand in front of tanks of an army he cowardly avoided serving in, attacking John McCain. It's funny. I almost created a scene yesterday in a restaurant, but I was taught to be polite. So I'm sitting at this dive restaurant in L.A., and a Chinese place, great place, huge Szechuan. I'll give it a plug. And I'm just having a, I'd stop quickly for lunch on the way somewhere, and I'm reading my Kindle trying to catch up on some things. And in the corners are these three elderly couples. And the women had hard perm helmets, and they were going on and talking about politics and, you know, who's running. And one woman started got in a fight with her husband. Trump's right. You're not a hero when you get captured. You know, you're in the wrong place like an idiot. And so I find myself standing up and walking over to explain exactly what happens when you attack a fuel drunk treetop level and come back for a second pass to make sure you get the target and win the Distinguished Flying Cross and the Silver Star. But she was in her late 80s and out of her mind. So I thought, I don't really want to pop out of the shadow and start screaming at an elderly halfwit. But it was right there in the average conversation, except it is fact because Trump's corruption has spread to his microphone as president. So, you know, those of us who've been waiting for some sort of Republican courage on this, you know, we've been disappointed. We're going to be, because they're practical politicians who've decided the Faustian bargain of cheap haircuts in the Senate, you know, is worth looking the other way. Breaks my heart. I'm like Stewart. I signed up for certain things some years ago. But I do think the wheel will turn. I mean, the thing that comforts me, even though the Democrats do look like they're flirting with socialism and all that kind of horrible stuff that maybe throws the election, is since the day Trump was elected, almost every time we mark Trump to market, ignoring all the talk and all the polling and all the bullshit in Washington, but we just let people vote, whether it's special elections in 2017, the midterms in 2018. In almost every case in any district that isn't rock solid Republican, the voters have been voting anti-Trump, coughing them up like a hairball. So I think that trend will continue, but we're going to have to wait through more of this insanity and more of this Trumpian stuff. And the McCain deal is the perfect illustration. If that's not enough for you to know Trump is unfit, then, you know, let's bring in the Singapore system and have 50 smart guys run the country, because it just isn't the way it ought to work.
No, I mean, the point there is that we all know that Donald Trump is Donald Trump, but you know, and so he makes these vile attacks on John McCain. But I think the real damage, as you point out, is the vile attacks that come from the Trumpists, that he has this bat signal out there, and I'm out of words, just the awful, deplorable attacks on not just on John McCain, but on his family and, you know, his wife, which is, you know, and these are people who I'm guessing would never conceivably pre-Trump have publicly attacked a hero like John McCain. And yet Trump has corrupted them. He has modeled this behavior. And even after he leaves the scene, I think that stain on people's character is going to be very hard to wipe away.
See, I'm even more pessimistic than that, Charlie. I'm not sure Trump did corrupt them. I'm not sure that they weren't corrupt. Because, you know, how do you change deeply held beliefs in 18 months? You don't. It means you didn't hold them deeply. And courage is not standing up to Donald Trump. Courage is getting out of the boat when the guy in front of you just got killed. And a lot of people in previous generations stood up to that test. And a lot of people in this generation and earlier generations are still doing it for America. It doesn't take courage to stand up to Donald Trump. It's just an absolute lack of any sort of decency. Trump is very good at humiliating people. You know, most of us don't wake up and think, like, how can I get through this day with maximizing my ability to humiliate other people? But Trump's been doing that since he's probably 6 years old. He's better at it than most people. And, you know, the problem with normal people is they tend to think when someone's acting abnormally that they will revert to normalcy. And this has been a great mistake of dealing with Trump. Any day now he's going to become normal because I'm normal. Well, he's not. And what he's doing is he's probing your weakness, and he's testing you. And he knows this. And so he says, I can shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue. What he's basically doing is shooting the Republican Party we believed in on Fifth Avenue, and they're reacting just as Trump predicted. They still support him.
No, it's
I agree with Stewart's point about you know, it's not only a question of courage, it's also telling us something we know but don't like to think about the wisdom of crowds. One of Trump's core equations is to turn politics into I'm right, they're evil. Mm-hmm. And if they're evil, you can do anything about them. Lock her up. So all of a sudden you can put on the armband and think I'm part of an army of good. I'm a good guy here. I'm going to go fight on Twitter against that damn John McCain and all the liars and the fake news. And of course, we're teaching the Democrats to act the same way, because when I'm right and you're evil, you know, I can kill you. That makes me good. Any tactic is fine. In fact, endorsed. So when you create a movement based on that and people can join it, they can check their decency at the door and rationalize the worst possible behavior that's lurking inside them. And we're finding that out. He has let that evil genie out of the bottle because he's the president. There's authority there, moral authority. And I agree. This is the part I'm dark about too. How do we put that toothpaste back in the tube once we've kind of handed this weapon out to demagogues on both sides?
Yeah. I don't know how you dial that back.
You're right. One thing I'm confident is that when you look back at this era, all these policy moments that Republicans are triumphing now, be it tax cuts, even Supreme Court justices, none of that is going to be remembered.
No.
It's like George Wallace. His governor, George Wallace, actually did a lot of good things in Alabama. He passed free textbooks for Alabama. But nobody's remembered as the free textbook George Wallace guy. You were the George Wallace guy. And all of these office holders to think, well, I made things less bad by passing this piece of legislation or stopping this, which is probably true. They probably did make it less bad. That's not what they're going to remember for. They're going to remember for the people who, in office, facilitated Donald Trump. And they should just face up to that and accept it and embrace it, because that's what it's going to be. This is the Donald Trump era, and they are the Donald Trump Republican Party, for the most part, those, unless you're actively saying why you're not, you are. And that's the legacy.
I think you're absolutely right. And one of the things I think we've learned in the last year and a half is how quickly people forget things. The news cycle working in basically dog years right now, that something that happened that was passed by Congress last week is completely forgotten about this week. So you're right. All of those things that loom so large right now, I think, are going to be forgotten. And it is going to be this stain. And there's a new poll out suggesting the growing pessimism of the American public that actually doesn't think that things are going to be getting better. They don't think that that America is you know, on the right trajectory in 2050. And you wonder, you know, do you make America great again by encouraging people or leading people to believe that, in fact, our government is not going to solve our political problems, that our kids' lives aren't going to be better? By the way, on this whole testing thing, I know when you were talking before, Stuart, I was thinking about, you know, I could shoot somebody in Fifth Avenue, in the middle of Fifth Avenue, and people would still vote for me. It is almost as if, and I don't want to give Trump credit for consciously thinking it through, but I think there's a visceral desire to humiliate and test the limits of humiliation. That okay, he's already proven that he can shoot you somebody in Fifth Avenue and you'll go along with it. So now he's thinking, well, what if I beat small puppies in the middle of Fifth Avenue? Would you go along with that? Okay, we've done that. What if I shot nuns in the middle of Fifth Avenue while performing an abortion? Would they still go along with that? Sort of just testing how far can I push this?
You know, Saddam Hussein famously, when he executed people, would make the family pay for the bullet.
Mm.
And that's what Donald Trump is doing. He is making the Republican Party pay for the bullet that is shooting the party that everyone who ran for office before Trump in the Republican Party would have said there are core principles that they believe in, like character counts, like personal responsibility, like fiscal sanity, like strong on Russia. All of those have been completely thrown out the window. And that's Trump knows that. And Trump doesn't care about ideology. Trump only cares about Trump. And he'd be running as a Trotskyite if he thought he could win. So it's just absolutely this innate sense that Trump has of how to manipulate and humiliate people. And it's absolutely sort of a strange, bizarre genius that he has. And Republicans are just going along and letting him do it.
So who?
And
who
he's in his own prison too. I mean, Trump is driven by these massive insecurities, and so he's got these kind of asymmetrical powers, and he's figured out how to hack the presidency of the United States because the whole thing is built on honor. You know, the presumption was that you could shame would have an impact, and that would regulate a presidential behavior because the powers of the president are big, and we're not in a system designed to hit the ejector seat very easily, other than in elections. So Trump has figured out by being shameless, the force field doesn't work on him. And because he's a prisoner of his massive, crazy insecurities. I mean, I like to joke that if somebody gave me a time machine, I wouldn't go back in time to kill baby Hitler. I would probably go back in time to tell Fred Trump not to be such an asshole to his kid, because the guy's a bit of a psychological monster. So he doesn't even control himself. And, you know, the whole thing is compounded with an alienated middle class, the real wage is not rising, that we have this perfect storm.
Well, no, you're right about this. When you were talking about the hacking the system, essentially what we found out is the presidency is based on an honor system, right? The assumption that you'd have honorable, you know, men or women in that job, and that they would behave that way. And now we're testing that also. As I've said before, I do think that Donald Trump's utter lack of shame, his shamelessness, is his superpower. He cannot be shamed. He cannot be embarrassed.
Yeah, in, this is someone who publicly talks about having sex with his daughter. You're not going to shame this guy. It's not just the presidency that's based on the sense of honor. It's all civil society. When it's 2 o'clock in the morning, you come to a red light, you stop at the red light, you're doing that because you're participating in a civil society that has rules, and you decided, okay, I can probably run this, but I'm not. And that really is the sort of thin tissue that holds civil societies together. When you look at normal, sane, functioning societies that seem to go stark raving mad in a matter of months, like Bosnia and Sarajevo, where you have people tortured now in the Olympic Stadium, it's because that thin fabric was ripped. And there's always this assumption that it can't happen in America, which is the fastest way to guarantee that it will happen. Because there's nothing particularly special about the idea that Americans can't hate each other.
No.
Of course we can, and we are.
Yeah, and we're not immune to history. All right, so another question I got asked yesterday that I found much more difficult to answer than I would have liked. Let's look forward, given all of this. So 10 years from now, who will be the bright, shining stars of the Republican Party? Who's going to lead us out of the wilderness? And my list was pretty thin. So help me out here.
Oh, who knows? I mean, I think the 50% chance it'll be a UFC cage fighter, and that will not lead us out of anywhere. But the Idiocracy as a documentary, not a movie of fiction, horror story will come true. Legacy Donald Trump. We will be the minority congressional party of gated communities with no power and a lot of things to complain about. Or we will have a reformation and we'll have a modernized conservatism out of the ashes. But it's going to be a long road to get there. And I don't know who's on the radar screen now that's the obvious person for that. But, you know, there are core ideas. The real Republican ideas do have saliency and attractiveness. If we can modernize them. I've got a friend who's an optimist in the car business, and he says, "Oh, Murphy, quit grousing. It's terrible, but you're Toyota. The best thing that ever happened to him was getting flattened in 45. 20 years later, they had brand new plants, and we Detroit guys did not. And look how it turned out. So you know, look at the long picture and think reformation, but it's going to be a really shitty decade.
You know, I was tempted to say Nikki Haley, but there was something in the back of my head that said, don't do it, don't do it. And of course, wake up this morning and Nikki Haley is tweeting out to Charlie Kirk. We are so proud of you, Charlie Kirk, this wonderful book. And I would have hit my head on the desk if I did that sort of thing. It was one of those, the power of corruption. Is there anybody in your mind when you think of like the people who most disappointed you in the last few years? You know, is like I never thought that guy would have, you know, been taken over.
Say the voters, the Republican voters, are extremely disappointing because they sell very cheap and for dark things. And Nikki's disappointing. On paper, she's got so much going for her, but I think she's every bit as cynical as Trump. I haven't have a crank theory. She wrote the New York Times editorial They have a little secret dossier to drop in 4-8 years when she runs to say, well, see, I was a patriot. You know, I don't have a single person. I just have an extremely short heroes list.
Yeah, so I had Bill Bennett on my list, you know, the guy that wrote the Book of Virtues. And when he went on cable television back in 2016 and said, never Trumpers suffer from moral vanity for not buying into Trump. That was kind of a soul crushing moment. But the list is so long now, he's sort of like, you know, dropped down to the near the bottom of the list. And Lindsey Graham, obviously, is, I mean, Lindsey Graham has decided that he wants his legacy to be compared to Uriah Heep. To be, you know, the ultimate obsequious sycophant. And you know, this is what I don't understand.
He thinks he's the Fritz Van Papen. He's the guy who's going to get inside and reason with him. Okay, we're making him chancellor. Yeah, how'd that end?
Okay, I've used that analogy, and then I'm thinking, you know, anytime you, what is the, is it Godwin's law? You invoke that? I actually did use the Franz von Papen, of course, which was, you know, all of the folks, Paul Ryan, Mike Pence was like, hey, don't worry. Once he gets into office, it won't be a problem. We'll have him redecorate the White House, you know, put gold.
Invite him to the gridiron. That's all
exactly,
he really
exactly, stuff like that. And we will run it just like, and we know how for students of history. Which like there's almost none left here, but what I don't understand is why someone like a Lindsey Graham or other members of the Senate don't have the perspective to say, look, if I behave this way, I'm going to look back on my career and history is going to look back on me in disgraceful ways. I mean, I understand the attraction of power, right? I mean, power, ego, celebrity, all of that stuff, but you would think there'd be a little bit of pride, or am I just being ridiculously naive?
You know, I think we're seeing this desperate need to belong and be approved versus a basic sense of decency. And, you know, that plays out, you know, in schoolyards and companies and neighborhoods across, you know, the world every day. And Republicans are proving that their need to belong and to be approved is greater than any sense of moral courage. You know, forgetting Hitler now, you always look at with say, like, what if George Wallace had been nominated and elected president for the Democrats, and the Democratic establishment accepted that?
Yeah.
What would that have done to the Democratic Party? Well, it would probably be a minority party now. It would probably be just, you know, a Southern kooky party. And I think that's what's happening with Trump. I'm very pessimistic about it. I don't know how you unsay these things. Mm-hmm. Not that, you know... demographics are destiny, but they're pretty close to destiny. And unless white people can figure out a way to quit dying, which I'm all for being one, but it's not looking very hopeful, the demographic tide for Republicans is cataclysmic.
Yeah,
it used to be 60% of the electorate when Reagan ran was high school, white high school or less educated. Now it's 30, and it's the fastest dropping demographic in the electorate. Ronald Reagan won 44 states, sweeping landslide, 1980, with 57% of the white vote. Mitt Romney lost with 57% of the white vote. So just because Donald Trump was able to just juice up the white vote a little bit and Hillary Clinton underperformed, that doesn't mean that we've repealed demographics and where it's going to be.
Yeah,
go back. You know, Trump won with 46.1%. Romney lost with 47.2%. Mm. So what's the difference? The difference is just that there was a smaller percentage of non-white voters. 2012 was the first time non-white voters participated in larger numbers than white voters. And increase in third-party vote. That's it. It's not about the economy or some you know, desperate sense of people being... they can't get ahead. They would have been drawn to Obama if that was the case. Obama dropped unemployment from close to 10% to 4%.
Yeah.
S&P 500 tripled under Obama. It's just, he's turned the party into this sense of grievance merchants.
And it's interesting because it's a compounding. Stewart's exactly right. I mean, I wrote this cranky column for Time magazine in 2008 called The Coming GOP Ice Age. All about demography and the shrinking white vote. And it was basically kind of hooted and pointed at. And, you know, the argument that I call mathematicians versus priests, that mathematicians like myself and Stewart were making was, hey, we got to widen the showroom here and because our core thing is shrinking. But what happened instead was we doubled down on the heat within the core thing, which Trump was able to kind of flukily with his 77,000 votes in those three states, win. But, you know, it was exactly the wrong way. It was what Wall Street guys call a dead cat bounce for the party. So it and then what made it harder for the mathematicians is when Trump won, all the priests said, see, we told you just had to listen to Rush Limbaugh on AM radio and it would change everything. So, you know, the tribe sitting there, they predicted a lightning strike, and at the exact time the friggin' lightning showed up. So all we mathematicians are tied to stakes now. But the laws of demography, they are powerful.
It's basically like going to, you know, a party and having a bunch of drinks and making it home safely and concluding that alcohol helps you drive better. Mm-hmm. It's probably the wrong conclusion. You really need to look at causality here. And unless the party can expand and appeal to more non-white voters, the party as a national political party is doomed. And it's also as a governing moral center is doomed. You have to be able to say at least you're trying to represent the whole country, to represent the whole country.
Yeah, well, and they don't appear to be interested in that at all. And so, there was a piece I'm trying to, I don't want to name the writer because I'm not sure I have the right guy, who was, you know, wondering, well, so what is the end game for you never Trumpers? I mean, you want to elect Democrats? And I turned that around. I said, well, what is the end game for Trumpism? If the end game is not just 2020, but it's 2024 and we're going into the 2030s, where do you think this is going to be leading long term if you alienate women and young people and Hispanics and African Americans and Asian Americans? What is your end game? Where do you think this is going to end up, you know, if you look past the next election cycle? I mean, look, it is certainly possible that Donald Trump could draw to an inside straight again next year through the Electoral College if the Democrats do, in fact, blow themselves up. But that doesn't mean that you don't have this demographic tsunami that's going to consume the party. And, you know, Republicans are going to try to say, well, that wasn't us. No, we're different. We're the new party and everything. But I don't know that that's going to stick. I think it's going to be indelible for a very long time. How long did it take the Republican Party to get over, you know, Hooverism in the 1930s?
Another analogy that I think is very apt is before 1964, Republicans in presidential races could get 30-35% of the African American vote.
Yeah.
All right, that's not great, but you get to 35, maybe, you know, you really get your stuff together. Maybe you could get to 40. Get to 40, you could see 45. It wasn't being annihilated. After 64, Civil Rights Movement, Civil Rights Act, when so many Republicans and Democrats who became Republicans in the South opposed it, it fell off a cliff. So it went from 30-35% to 10% and under. And we've never recovered. And I see absolutely no reason to believe that's not happening with non-white voters at large. And once you say these things, how do you unsay them?
Yeah, right.
No, I agree on the stain, and I'm torn on the other. It all makes sense. I would say Trump will end badly. I don't know if it'll end badly next year in the reelect or midway through, but Trump is self-destructive. He's the atomic clock of what he is. He doesn't change or improve. It'll end badly, which will lead to Democratic victories. After that, the thing will hit a restart where if the Democrats govern from the identity left,
right,
and flirt with socialism, they turn into the Labor Party in the 70s, the country's going to pay a huge price. And over time, there's going to be a vacuum to fill for an alternative. And if out of the ashes we can build something, I think we can have the party redefined. Now, there's no guarantee we'll build anything smart. You know, we could have a new improved Trumpism. So I have all sorts of worries about it. But I think the big wheel will turn. And there will be, if you look at this in kind of decade terms, there will be a window to bring back things in a new modern conservative ideology, which would have a shot. Now, a lot of ifs and maybes there, but I do think politics is organic and it grows. And, you know, where it goes, I don't know, but there will be change. Last point is, you know, blockchain is eventually going to let you vote on your phone. And so we could be heading to a multi-party future here, which I'm not at all sure is a good thing, but it'll be a lot more enabled by that kind of technology in 15 years. than it is now with our kind of 1903 system to nominate and distribute politicians through the two-party system. So I have a big question mark on the future. There's no doubt in the short term we've committed political hara-kiri with this guy.
So both of you guys have run presidential campaigns in the past. Are you still in Republican politics? Are you doing anything? Are you consulting? Are you running campaigns? Can you say?
All right. Stuart, you want to go first?
Okay.
no, I will. I don't care.
Stuart has left the country. He's fled to Canada.
No fool. Yeah, I'm learning Chinese.
Mandarin or Cantonese. You know, I'm part of a firm, and the firm's very actively involved in Republican politics. And look, you know, I have a lot of friends that are big Donald Trump supporters. And you know, they're still friends of mine, and they think I've lost my mind, and I think they've lost their mind, but that's kind of where their minds meet. Everybody I work for, I really can say that I believe in. Okay. And I'm not disappointed in it. And that drives me, frankly, to work in a lot of governor's races.
Okay. So, Mike?
Yeah, no, he's right about that. The governor's, there is some hope there. You know, I have not left the Republican Party. I'm going to stay and fight to the last foxhole. I've managed to shrink our firm a little bit in D.C., Washington, by not putting the right flag up in front of my store. And so it's been an interesting transition. I don't do candidate campaigns, but I am active in advocacy and some independent expenditures and all that. So most of what I do now is corporate consulting. But I'm going to stay and fight. I do talk to a lot of Republican politicians. It's funny. Here's the conversation, because I guess their view ought to be heard. I'll talk to like one of these senators, and they will say Trump's an idiot. He can't even work a TV remote. I've seen it in the Oval. They have to bring in somebody. And I said, yeah, why don't you say that? And he said, you know how much fun it would be for me to go back to my state and rant and rave like you about Trump and how unfit? My wife would speak to me again. It would be fantastic. But an hour later, I'd have a primary from a guy in an aluminum foil suit who might win, and Trump will not change at all. So I'll have no impact because Trump doesn't change. So I'll blow myself up for no outcome worth a damn other than potentially lose my seat where I can work quietly behind the scenes to, you know, get ready for the moment where we all leave our living rooms and throw the Germans out of Paris. And I said, well, if 10 of you would stand up, it would do a lot. And they always say, great, call me when you got the first three. I'll be number four. And so that said, there are a few of them talking, kind of putting on their Howard Baker pants and getting ready if the Mueller stuff is really bad. So there are more cracks, I think, in the system. If Donald Trump had the powers of the amazing Kreskin and could read minds, I would not recommend that he walk through the Republican Senate conference because there's not a lot of goodwill there. He'd probably curl up in a ball and sob. But, you know, we'll see. So I'm hanging on to slim hopes that we can make trouble in the party. But I'm out of the candidate business. And frankly, candidates who have to work in Republican politics would be an idiot to hire me.
Yeah. Okay. You know, so
I think it's a negative.
I want to seize upon that moment of optimism there. Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry, Stuart.
No, I was going to say, and for the first time, I went out a lot on television and, you know, tried to make a case against Trump with obviously great effect in 16. And if Julian Assange ever hacks my emails, he will find all kinds of elected Republican officials cheering me on, thanking me for this, right up to about 9 o'clock on election night.
Yep.
And it stopped. Yeah. And Donald Trump didn't change. They changed. And that's just deeply disappointing.
I think we've all been there. Gentlemen, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time and sharing with me in these difficult circumstances. And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back on Monday, and we'll do this all over again.